This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Palestinian footballer Mahmoud Sarsak remains on hunger strike for nearly 90 days, determined to continue until he dies or Israel frees him. We'll have the latest update from Sahar Francis of the Palestinian prisoner support organization Ad-Damir. Also, Africans fear more violence as Israeli Knesset members incite racism, including a minister who says that Israel, quote, belongs to the white man. Gaza farmers rush to grow wheat under fear of Israeli fire, while a farmer in the West Bank refuses to allow settlers to take over his land. Israeli politicians call for a campaign to pay Palestinian families $10,000 to leave Nazareth forever. And news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We continue our coverage of the hunger striker Mahmoud Sarsak, a 25-year-old football player on the Palestinian national team who has been refusing food for nearly 90 days in prison. Sarsak has been protesting his indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called unlawful combatants law. And according to more than a dozen health and human rights groups, the former star athlete is close to death. He began his hunger strike on March 19th. The Electronic Intifada reported on Tuesday that Sarsak's lawyer said he is determined to continue until he dies or Israel agrees to free him. The news came as major public figures, including football legend Eric Cantona and Sepp Blatter, the president of FIFA, the World Football Organization, joined the growing international calls on Israel to free Sarsak and end its abuses of human rights. After coming close to death on Sunday, Sarsak has reportedly agreed to take milk only until today when the Israeli High Court reviewed his case. For news on what happened today at the High Court, we go to Sahar Francis, director of Ad-Damir, the Palestinian prisoner advocacy organization in Haifa. Sahar, tell us what you know about what happened today at the High Court and what this means for Mahmoud Sarsak.
Actually, we don't have an accurate information about what's going on in the case of Mahmoud Sarsak, because on Tuesday the news was that today he was supposed to have a judicial review in the district court, which didn't happen today actually. And instead there was two petitions for the court, the district court on the family visit case and in transferring him for the hospital, but both are rejected because the prison authority claims that he's in a good health now and he stopped his hunger strike and he's getting a liquid food. And of course we are not sure because our lawyer wasn't allowed to visit him today. We don't know exactly what he's getting beside the milk, because his family and his lawyer said that he's just getting milk in the last 3 days. And we were supposed to get information today about whether he's going to be released very soon or they are still insisting to release him just on the 22nd of August, within 2 months.
Sahar, it's almost 90 days that Mahmoud Sarsak has been on hunger strike. Last week, Physicians for Human Rights Israel and Ad-Damir and about a dozen other human rights organizations in Palestine issued urgent appeals saying that because he's, you know, been on hunger strike for so long that his body is starting to shut down. So what's your response to the Israeli prison service and the Israeli government saying that he's in good health now and therefore the chance to review his case could be postponed? We don't know till when.
Actually, this is our concern, that we feel that the prison authority is trying to give a picture like Mahmoud Sarsak stopped his hunger strike and now he's okay, while it's not true. Even if he stops his hunger strike, actually after such a very long period of being in hunger strike for around 90 days, this is very dangerous and he's still under a very immediate threat of getting internal collapse for the organ or any heart attack or other serious development on his health conditions. And this is why we insist that he should be transferred, even if he stopped his hunger strike. Now he should be treated by a very high professional physicians team, that they know how to deal with such case of a person that he didn't eat for such a long time, because they can develop problems even after starting to get the food. So I think the behavior of the IPS is totally irresponsible for and not taking in consideration the serious health conditions of Mahmoud Sarsak.
What's the significance of all of these public figures, including FIFA, coming out in support of Sarsak and demanding that he be freed by Israel?
Of course, I totally agree that this is very significant and this is very worrying for the Israelis that such public figures from the football world is interfering and demanding his release and issuing statement, although we feel it's a little bit late. Like we were expecting such a big pressure before reaching the 88 days under hunger strike. But it's good that it happened. And I think this is with also the political pressure coming from the different countries or the UN level or the EU level, this is all together is putting Israel another time like it happened in the case of Khadr Adnan and the general hunger strike. And there are lots of pressure. And this is why they are pushing to say that he stopped his hunger strike and he's in good, stable health conditions.
Sahar, what information do you have about some of the other Palestinian prisoners currently on hunger strike, such as Akram Rikhawi? What do you know about their condition right now?
Also, Akram Rikhawi is under bad health conditions and a very serious threat to his life since he's also under hunger strike for a long period. He started his hunger strike in the 12th of April. And Akram, the problem that his petition to be released on health circumstances was rejected, and this is why he was deciding to continue his hunger in his hunger strike. Until now, he wasn't transferred to be held in a hospital, in a normal hospital, which means we still have big concern about what could happen in any moment for his health. He's a sick person. He was suffering all these years in the prison. Actually, he was held in the clinic in a Ramli prison. He wasn't in a normal section in the Israeli prisons, which means that his health conditions is very critical now after such long period of hunger strike. As well, the third detainee that he's under hunger strike, Al-Barq, reaching, he's less under hunger strike, but as well, he's more than 3 weeks under hunger strike, which means that he's reaching a point where his conditions would be starting to be worried and he needs to be treated and also transferred for a hospital to be under daily follow-up, actually. But unfortunately, we didn't get visits this week for all of them, and the prison authority is keep delaying the lawyers' visits, and of course, they didn't get family visit these detainees under hunger strike as well.
Okay, well, we're going to keep following this story, of course. Thank you so much, Sahar, and we will be back with you.
You're welcome.
That was Sahar Francis of Ad-Damir speaking to us from Haifa. For more on the story, visit electronicintifada.net. African refugees and asylum seekers have been violently attacked by racist groups in Tel Aviv, whose actions are backed by Israeli parliamentarians seeking to deport non-Jewish individuals and families. Israeli governmental leaders have a long history of racist statements against Africans. Eli Yishai, Israel's interior minister, said recently that he would use, quote, all the tools to expel the foreigners, claiming that, quote, Israel belongs to the white man. Speaking to Army Radio in 2009, Yishai said that asylum seekers bring, quote, a profusion of diseases to the country. And in 2010, Benjamin Netanyahu remarked that Africans pose, quote, a concrete threat to the Jewish and democratic character of Israel. Jillian Kessler-Damour wrote in a report from Interpress Service on Tuesday that, quote, on Sunday, the Israeli immigration authorities began arresting South Sudanese migrants in preparation for deporting them from the country. According to the Israeli press, 8 people have been arrested in Eilat and central Israel so far. Until earlier this year, the South Sudanese were given unofficial group protection in Israel, which entitled them to remain in the country and protected them against detention. But the Israeli government argued that since South Sudan achieved independence in July 2011, the refugees could safely return home. In another report from Interpress Service, Maya Guarnieri wrote on Monday that, quote, on the evening of May 23rd, a number of Jewish Israelis gathered in South Tel Aviv to protest the presence of Africans in their neighborhood. Members of Israel's parliament, the Knesset, gave inflammatory speeches at the rally. Miri Regev, a member of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party, declared that Africans are a, quote, cancer in Israel's body. Michael Ben-Ari from the far-right National Union Party claimed that Africans are rapists and said the time for talk is over. Mobs emboldened by such speeches have chased and beaten asylum seekers, vandalized African-owned stores, and attacked cars carrying African men. There are approximately 60,000 African asylum seekers living in the country, 85% of them from Eritrea and Sudan. Although they remain in the state legally, the state does not allow the refugees to work. African asylum seekers take odd jobs and crowd into cheap apartments in poor neighborhoods, including South Tel Aviv. Those who cannot scrape together the money for rent live in parks. Knesset members have participated in anti-African protests like the one that led to violence last month, since such demonstrations began in 2010. Most of the Knesset members who have joined in are from the far right. But Miri Regev belongs to Likud, a mainstream party led by Netanyahu, a popular prime minister who enjoys high approval ratings from the Israeli public. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. Reporting for Interpress Service from occupied East Jerusalem, Gillian Kessler-Damour also wrote about the Shuafat refugee camp, which is almost entirely cut off from the rest of the city by Israel's wall. A new report from the Association for Civil Rights in Israel estimates that of the more than 360,000 Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, 78% live below the poverty line. Currently, 84% of the children in Jerusalem also live in poverty. Israel's wall in the West Bank and checkpoints separating Palestinian neighborhoods from Jerusalem, which formerly acted as the bustling center of Palestinian economic, cultural, and political life, has now made accessing the city an arduous, if not impossible, task. More than 20,000 Palestinians live in the Shuafat refugee camp. About half are Jerusalem residents and carry blue ID cards, but they must now cross a checkpoint on their way to work and school and to get services in the rest of Jerusalem. It is estimated that 90,000 Palestinian Jerusalemites now find themselves on the other side of the wall, including residents of the Shuafat refugee camp. To read more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. Writing from the Gaza Strip, our correspondent Rami Al-Megari reported on the struggle of wheat farmers to make a living under constant threat of Israeli attacks, especially on agricultural land near the so-called buffer zone along the militarized eastern boundary with Israel. According to the Gaza-based Agricultural Ministry, this year's wheat season is the best ever in terms of quality and quantity. Though wheat is not considered a major crop in the coastal enclave, agricultural officials maintained that it would signal a message of determination by Gaza farmers to continue farming and contributing to the local market. The straw from the wheat also contributes about 40% of the animal fodder consumed in Gaza. However, Al-Megari reported, a Gazan agricultural official said he didn't think Gaza could ever reach self-sufficiency due to a lack of sufficient farmland and irrigation and the blockade imposed by Israel, which makes trade in and out of the Gaza Strip difficult. Another major problem is that much arable land inside Gaza is off-limits due to the Israeli-declared buffer zone along Gaza's eastern boundary. Israeli forces frequently fire at Palestinians entering the zone and even those who stay outside of it. It is estimated that some 6,000 acres of farmland cannot be used because of the threat from Israel. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Aghsan Barghouti of the Stop the Wall campaign reported for the Electronic Intifada that Khalid Abdullah Yassin, a farmer from Dura, a village near Ramallah, owns no more than 11 acres of land, yet this small patch of Palestine and what happens to it over the coming weeks could forecast Israel's outright contempt and blatant disregard for not only international law, but also its own. In 1995, the villagers of Dura, already living in the shadow of the Israeli settlement of Bet El, began to notice that settlers were regularly encroaching on their land. While at first the settlers built temporary structures in which to celebrate their various festivals, the structures began to take on a more permanent nature and severely disrupted the agricultural life of the village. In response to this creeping colonization of their land, the villagers started to demonstrate, and it was during one of these demonstrations that a young man from the village was killed. As the wall built by Israel to annex a large part of the West Bank cuts right across the hills of the village, it became impossible for Yassin to access his land and ascertain whether or not the settlers had begun to build there. Between 2006 and 2007, Yassin started to build a legal case for the restoration of his land with help from many different friends and groups. In 2008, after 10 months of legal battles, the Israeli High Court issued its decision that Yassin was entitled to his land and that all structures built by the settlers should be demolished. However, Barghouti added in his report, the Israeli government, sensing the dangerous potential of enforcing such a ruling for Israeli colonial expansion on Palestinian land, defied the High Court's ruling, procrastinated, and failed to carry out the demolition orders. Once again, in September of last year, the Israeli High Court rejected the Israeli government's appeal against the decision and reiterated its initial order to demolish the settler buildings on Yassin's land. With the demolition date set for May 1st this year, the Israeli government made an historic decision in late April to inform the High Court that it would not enforce the court order to dismantle the six buildings built on Palestinian land. The reason for its refusal apparently was internal pressures within the Israeli coalition government, particularly from some ministers of the Likud party. In a bid to counter this legal threat, the continued colonial expansion on Palestinian land, which already sees 500,000 settlers in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, the Israeli government offered to lease the land from Yassin in order to avoid carrying out the demolitions ordered by the High Court. Khaled Yassin and his neighbors, however, say they will not negotiate the sale of this land to those who seek to colonize and ultimately expel them. Aghsan Barghouti wrote, "To negotiate and bargain with the oppressor and usurper of this land is not an alternative worth considering." For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. Ben White reported this week that in Upper Nazareth, the chair of Yisrael Beiteinu, the party headed by far-right Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, has called for a campaign to pay Palestinian citizens to leave the city. As reported by Hakol HaYehudi, the Jewish Voice, Alex Gedalkin has suggested that $10,000 be paid to every family that would sell its house, quote, and leave town forever. Justifying his proposal, the Yisrael Beiteinu activist explained that such a move would, quote, benefit everyone by, quote, avoiding needless friction in the city and maintaining the Jewish character of Upper Nazareth. The report also notes that the mayor of Upper Nazareth, quote, praised the initiative but stressed that the municipality cannot provide assistance for legal reasons. Mayor Gapso has previously explained that he is, quote, all for a democratic Upper Nazareth, but first of all a Jewish one. In 2010, a message from the mayor on the city's website stated, quote, just as David Ben-Gurion and Shimon Peres said in the 1950s that the Galilee must be Jewish, we say the same about Nazareth elite, Upper Nazareth. The primary goal is to put brakes on the demographic deterioration, end quote. For more on this story, visit Ben White's blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. We now go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The Electronic Intifada reported this week that the Palestinian Trade Union Coalition for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions has issued a statement of solidarity with the European trade unions resisting public spending cuts and job losses. Founded at a conference in Ramallah last year, the Palestinian Trade Union Coalition for BDS is made up of all the political blocs from the coalition of major Palestinian trade unions. The statement begins, quote, ahead of a summer of conferences and meetings to organize opposition to austerity, the Palestinian Trade Union Coalition for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions is proud to stand in solidarity with trade unions resisting attacks on working conditions, cuts to public services, and job losses. The waves of strikes and demonstrations taking place and being planned across Europe and the defeat of pro-austerity governments in France and Greece are timely reminders of the importance and power of struggle, and of the fact that ordinary working people oppose the ideologically driven efforts to make them pay for a crisis caused by powerful political and financial elites. The statement then goes on to express gratitude to the Swedish Congress of Trade Unions, which recently voted to adopt BDS measures and to restate support for trade union involvement in proactive BDS campaigns and a boycott of the Histadrut, the racist Israeli trade union entity. The statement adds, trade unions around the world are taking steps to reconsider and even sever their ties with Histadrut, the colonial Israeli trade union entity that has always played a key role in Israel's system of oppression over the Palestinian people. The Histadrut has issued statements in favor of both Israel's 22-day war of aggression in 2008-2009 and the Israeli massacre of humanitarian activists on board the Freedom Flotilla in 2010. The organization participated in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians during the 1948 Nakba, contributed to the construction of and holds financial interests in illegal Israeli settlements, has failed to take action to prevent systematic discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel, and has withheld funds owed to Palestinian workers. For more on the global BDS movement, visit electronicintifada.net/tags/BDS. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out Alexander Bilet's op-ed on pop superstar Madonna, and despite her recent performance in Tel Aviv, how the BDS movement continues to grow. Also, Palestinian political prisoner Amir Mahoul's letter from Israeli prison, which gives an insider's analysis of the hunger strike movement, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also send comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.